Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to episode 303 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where we look at mysteries from the twin perspectives of faith and reason. In this episode, we're talking about the book AA 1025, The Memoirs of an Anti-Apostle and Communist Infiltration of the Catholic Church. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today is Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
In 1972, a book with the title AA 1025, The Memoirs of an Anti-Apostle, appeared. The back of the current Tan Books edition states, in the 1960s, a French Catholic nurse, Marie Carré, attended an auto crash victim who was brought into her hospital in a city she purposely does not name. The man lingered there near death for a few hours and then died. He had no identification on him, but he had a briefcase in which there was a set of quasi-biographical notes. She kept these notes and read them, and because of their extraordinary content, decided to publish them. The result is this little book about a communist who purposely entered the Catholic priesthood, along with many, many others, with the intent to subvert and destroy the church from within. This little book, his strange yet fascinating and illuminating set of biographical notes, tells of his commission to enter the priesthood, his various experiences in the seminary, and the means and methods he used and promoted to help effect from within the auto-dissolution of the Catholic Church. So, who was this mysterious communist agent? Where did he come from? And what did he do to destroy the Catholic Church? That's what we'll be talking about on this episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, why did you want to talk about this story?
Well, I've been aware of AA 1025 for a long time. I remember seeing it in paperback, you know, little paperback copies of it from Tan Books, back in the 1990s when I converted to the Catholic faith. And over the years, I've had questions about it from different people, and I've had requests to cover it on Mysterious World and discuss the communist anti-Catholic conspiracy that it describes. So today, that's what we're going to be talking about.
And how do you want to begin looking at this mystery?
By starting right at the beginning of the book and telling the story. It begins with a prologue written by the nurse, which the back of the book says is Marie Carré. The prologue states,
I am only a mere nurse who has nevertheless seen many persons die and who continues to believe in the mercy of God and who has experienced how the will of the invisible God reveals itself at the right moment. I am only a nurse, and I saw, in a country that I will not name, in a hospital that must remain anonymous, I saw a man die following an automobile accident, a man without a name, without a nationality. I mean, without identification papers. Nevertheless, he had in his briefcase documents I was forced to examine. Apparently, this text of about 100 typewritten pages could bring no clue allowing one to identify this injured man. But who knows? Moreover, let me be honest. And since I have spoken of confession, let me be completely honest about it. I already had decided to read these intimate notes. So I gave in quickly to this temptation. I could not foresee that, by letting my feminine curiosity stifle my scruples as a nurse, that I should come upon a voracious document that would upset and overwhelm me. As this text was too serious to be simply thrown into the fire, too compelling to be entrusted into anybody's hands, or it seemed too truthful to me. Do not try to find out who I am. You will never do so. But my injured patient seemed to be more or less a Slav. But this is not particularly important since he could not speak. I gave him a name. I called him Michael because this archangel often helped me.
Upon reading the 100-page manuscript, she discovered that Michael, as she named him, was actually a Soviet agent. And after he died, she decided to publish his manuscript in order to warn people about what he'd done and what was going on. Michael's own manuscript begins this way.
I ask myself why I feel like writing my memoirs. It is rather strange. I believe that I write them because I do so every night in my dreams, whence a kind of complicity that forces me, I imagine, to continue during the daytime. But it matters not. No one will ever read them. I will destroy them in due time. I am the man without a name, the man without a family, without a country, and without heritage. I am one of those people whom bourgeois and bureaucrats despise. On account of this, and of those who have wanted to be good to me, I have suffered stupidly.
Michael then goes on to relate what appears to be his first memory.
I was at first the small boy without a name. I seemed to be 3 years old. I was crying and dragging myself on a Polish road. This was in 1920. Therefore, I can safely presume that I was born in 1917. But where and from whom? It seems that I could scarcely speak, that my Polish was very poor and my Russian still worse. I did not appear to understand German. Who was I? I could not even say my name anymore. For, after all, I had had a name, and I had answered to the call of my name. Hereafter, I will have to be content with the name chosen by my adoptive parents.
So, Michael was apparently born in 1917. His first memory took place in Poland. He appeared to be Slavic, which would point to an origin in Eastern Europe. But from his lack of skill with various languages, it appears he was not from Poland, Russia, or Germany. He knew his birth name at the time, but he no longer remembers it. Fortunately, he was soon found dragging himself along the Polish road and adopted.
Even today, after 50 years, a wave of anger, although much lessened, crosses my heart every time that I recall Dr. and Mrs. X. They were good. They were generous. They were magnanimous. They had no child, and they adopted me. They loved me more, I believe, than a child of their own. They loved me because I had dragged them out of the despair in which sterility had plunged them.
He was thus adopted by a doctor, a medical doctor, as the text soon makes clear, and his wife, who could not have children of their own. The text describes his feelings about them in the present after 50 years. Since he was born in 1917 and discovered by the couple in 1920, that distance of 50 years would put the writing of the manuscript around 1970, plus or minus a few years. And his time with the doctor and his wife was very happy. He writes,
I believe that they considered me as a gift from heaven, for they had such a strong piety that they referred to God all that happened to them. Of course, they taught me as if it were a game to do likewise. Their virtue was so great that I never heard them speak ill about anyone. At the time they found me, crying alone on a road, they were still young, about 35 years of age. They were very good-looking, and I was quickly sensitive to the almost exaggerated love that united them. When they looked at each other, then kissed, a pleasant feeling plunged me into delight. They were my father and my mother, and I would say these possessive adjectives with a very juvenile ardor. My mother, especially, showed me such excess love that I should have become unbearable. I do not know why it was not so.
So Michael says that his mother almost spoiled him, and he doesn't know why he didn't become unbearable. However, he may not have that much self-awareness on this issue. After reading the manuscript, I personally would say he did become unbearable. He's very egocentric, and I would not have sought out his company. Michael also, though, excelled in school, and he did so well that as a reward, they decided to take a family trip from Poland to Rome and Paris when he was 14. That would have been around 1931. But then something horrible happened that changed the course of his life forever.
One night when my eyelids refused to obey me and to stay open, I imagined that my father must have some kind of medicine to keep sleep away. So I tiptoed to the parlor. They were in the adjoining room and were talking about me. They were worried about my passport, saying that I was not their son. It was like a thunderbolt, do you know? At least that is what novelists say in like circumstances. But I say that it is still worse and that human language simply has no word to express such abomination. My body ached from head to toe. I did not know pain. That is why its first visit seized me completely and took command of my life for a certain time. My pain urged me to leave, and I did so at once, without bringing anything with me. I would even have liked to leave naked, so as to owe nothing to those people. For surely they were and are always those people. The hatred that I feel for them matches the love that they showed me. For they always lied to me, even if they really loved me. That I will never forgive them for. I forgive nothing by principle. If I were logical, I would be grateful to them. It is thanks to them that I am today one of the most redoubtable secret agents. I've become God's personal enemy, the one who has decided to have taught and proclaimed in the whole world the death of a God who, in fact, has never existed.
This may indicate that the doctor and his wife may have done something fishy when they took Michael into their home. If they had adopted him outright, then his passport would have him listed as their son. So maybe they just found him on a road and took him in without going through the actual adoption process. Kind of like in some versions of the Superman story where Ma and Pa Kent run across baby Kal-El just before a severe winter strikes, and they pretend that he's their biological son that Martha had over the winter when they were snowed in. In any event, the doctor and his wife apparently won't be able to produce a passport listing Michael as their son, and they're worried about what will happen if they try to take him abroad. Michael overhears them discussing this, and it isn't clear to me whether Michael knew he wasn't their biological child. He does have that memory of being found around 11 years earlier at age 3, including not knowing the Polish language, which the doctor and his wife would have spoken. But he acts as if he's learning this for the first time, that he's just learned on the verge of this international trip that he's been adopted. He feels betrayed, and he instantly comes to intensely hate his parents despite all the love they've shown him. So he runs away, and he decides to travel east and go to Vladivostok in the Soviet Union, which is way over on the Pacific coast of Russia and is about 6,500 miles from Poland. So Michael wants to get really, really far away from his adoptive parents as far as possible while still remaining on the continent. He left without taking any provisions for this trip, and he even wished that he could have left his clothes behind so as to owe nothing to his adoptive parents, who were now just those people to him, meaning those hated people.
It would be kind of hard for a 14-year-old boy with no supplies to make his way from Poland to Vladivostok. How far did he get?
Not far. Within a few days, before he made it to the Russian border even, he was so exhausted and hungry that he fell asleep and was unconscious for more than 24 hours. When he came to, a woman was tending to him in her home. She fed him, and she knew that he was planning to travel to Russia because he had spoken of this in his sleep. She also knew his name, his adopted name, because there had been articles about him running away in the newspaper. In them, his parents begged for him to return, and they promised not to scold him. But Michael replied,
"I have no parents."
The woman then said that she had relatives in Russia and offered to help him cross the border. Michael asked her to take a letter to a friend of his from a rich Russian family that he knew, and she did so. Michael remembered that his friend had an uncle in Leningrad that was a civil servant. He told his friend that he wanted to go to Russia and become someone great in the Communist Party, and he asked for money. The woman returned with a letter from his friend. It contained a letter of introduction to his uncle, and it contained, in his words, a nice bundle of money. So Michael was now off to Leningrad, today known as St. Petersburg, which was a more obtainable goal as it was only 725 miles away instead of 6,500. He made his way across the border, though he refuses to say how for what he calls reasons easily guessed, such as the fact it was an illegal crossing. He made his way to the uncle, who he liked very much, and he told the uncle of his desire to join and rise in the Communist Party.
The uncle told me that I would have to study first of all the doctrine of the party and languages. All would depend on the quality of my studies. I answered that in everything I would always be first, and that I would soon know more than my professors.
So as you can tell, Michael has something of an ego on him.
I studied ferociously for 6 years. My two only joys were my trimestrial visit to the uncle and my hatred for God, with the certainty of becoming the unquestioned chief of universal atheism.
The 14-year-old Michael thus wants to become the unquestioned chief of universal atheism. Nice to have goals. Fortunately, he found learning the needed languages and Communist Party teachings was easy for him.
My determination to learn the maximum was greatly helped by an astonishing memory. After reading a book attentively, I knew it by heart, even if it were written in a pretentious style. But I also had the faculty of retaining only what was worthwhile. My distinctly superior intelligence would retain only the valuable ideas, and I knew how to criticize even the greatest professors.
At the end of the 6 years of study, which takes us up to 1937, he met with the uncle again.
On that day, I noticed that he was really a high police officer, as I had always supposed him to be. He made me a tough proposal, capable, he thought, of upsetting me. He said to me, "I am now going to send you to practice a militant and international atheism. You will have to fight all religions, but principally the Catholic, which is better organized. To do so, you will enter a seminary and become a Roman Catholic priest." A moment of silence, during which I let joy pervade me while I kept an appearance of total indifference, was my only answer. The uncle was satisfied, and he did not hide it. With the same calm, he continued, "To be able to enter a seminary, you will have to return to Poland, reconcile yourself with your adoptive family, and present yourself to the bishop. I need you to be accepted by a true bishop of your native country, Poland. But we do not intend to have you pursue your religious studies in that country. No. You will be sent to a country across the Atlantic, but this is confidential. And you will simulate surprise when you receive that order. Yes, we are led to fear a European body ached for a fool who rules Germany."
This being in 1937, Germany was ruled by Adolf Hitler. World War II would begin in 1939, just 2 years later, and the uncle and his associates were afraid that this would gum up their plans for Michael, so they wanted to get him out of Europe for his seminary studies.
"Therefore, it seems wiser to have you study somewhere else, Canada, for example. We have another motive also. It is that European seminaries are much more strict than those of America. I know that you could endure 6 years of very strict seminary life without ever going out, but that is not the point. We need to have you learn what is going on in the world, and it is wise to be able to speak to the world in order to make it lose its faith. And it is to be understood without ever being suspected. It would be of no avail to send young men to seminaries if they got caught. No, you will remain a priest until death, and you will behave as a faithful and chaste priest."
Part of Michael's assignment in seminary would be to figure out how to destroy, in the uncle's words, everything that he was taught, and to that end, he would keep the uncle informed of what he was learning.
"You will write to me every week, very shortly, to mention all the slogans that you wish to spread in the world, with a brief explanation of the reasons that have prompted you to choose them. At the end of a certain time, more or less long, you will put into direct action with the network. That is, you will have 10 persons under your orders, and each of these 10 will also have 10 other persons under their orders. The 10 persons who will be directly under your orders will never know you. To reach you, they will have to pass through me. Thus, you will never be denounced. We already have in our service numerous priests in all countries where Catholicism is implanted. But you will never know one another. One is a bishop. maybe you will enter into contact with him. It will depend upon the rank that you reach.
Michael would thus be in charge of 100 people, though he would never meet any of them. Through the uncle, slogans to attack religion would be distributed through the 100 people, and they would be placed in the popular press by writers who didn't even know that they were working for the Communist Party. But Michael had a question.
I asked him how I could reach him if war broke out. He had foreseen everything. I would receive, in due time, a letter mailed from a free country and out of reach of hostilities. I would recognize such a letter to be valid because it would contain my secret appellation, that is AA1025. AA meant anti-apostle. I was therefore led to think that the number 1025 was my service number. To my great surprise, I had guessed right. Therefore, I cried out, 1,024 priests or seminarians have entered this career before me. That is correct, he answered coldly. I was not discouraged, but hurt and furious. I would have willingly strangled those 1,024 men. I only said, do you really need that many? The uncle only smiled. It was useless to hope that I could conceal my thoughts. So I added pitifully, one must believe that they did not accomplish much good work if you continue to recruit more of them. But he would not satisfy my curiosity. I wished at least to learn if I could come into contact with some of them, but the uncle assured me that I would never know even one of them.
So Michael would be anti-apostle number 1025 among the more than 1,000 men infiltrated into the Catholic Church. But he would never meet any of them. Michael comments,
I felt an impatient desire to leave Europe because the welfare of humanity would have been endangered by my death, or even only by the degradation brought about by an extended military service.
Michael is so important to the future of humanity that if he got drafted into the war, much less killed in one, that the welfare of humanity itself would be endangered. But before he even engaged in his seminary studies, he came up with an idea for how to fight religion. He told the uncle,
you must drive into the head of men, and particularly into the head of churchmen, to search for, at any price, a universal religion into which all churches would be melded together. So that this idea could take form and life, we must inculcate in pious people, especially Roman Catholics, a feeling of guilt concerning the unique truth in which they pretend to live. My idea was launched by non-Catholics, and the Catholic Church has always closed its doors to such a program. It is precisely why I wanted to study the way to make it change its mind. I know that this will not be easy. That we will have to work hard at it during 20 or even 50 years. But how we should succeed in the end? By what means, the uncle asked. By numerous and subtle means.
So to destroy religion, Michael says that they should create a universal religion by merging all churches together. This will take 20 to 50 years, but he assures the uncle that by numerous and subtle means, none of which he specified for the uncle, they will eventually succeed. Michael had written out these ideas in a dossier that he gave to the uncle.
The uncle started at once to read it, something I never dared to hope. This proved to me that he was laying great hopes in me. How he had reason to do so, the dear old man.
So the uncle had reason to lay great hopes in Michael, and this was a key moment. As Michael says,
was it not important, before all else, that I should then and there jump over many ranks and go ahead of the largest number possible of the 1,024 predecessors of mine? Who could not surely be so worthy as I was?
The uncle told him to come back 8 days later for an answer. And when he did, there was a high-ranking communist official there, a chief. The chief told him,
from now on, you are on the list of our active secret agents. You will give orders every week. I rely on your zeal. I readily admit that it will take a long time to destroy all religions from within. Nevertheless, it is necessary that the orders which you will give find an echo, notably among writers, journalists, and even theologians. It is to be understood that we have a team who watches the religious writings of the whole world and gives its advice on the usefulness of directives given by such or such an agent. Therefore, do your best to please. I have high hopes, because it seems to me that you have already understood it all by yourself.
Michael didn't really like the chief. He found him an unpleasant person, but he was gratified by what the man said.
I congratulated myself that this personage was so unpleasant, because I was cured in advance of all timidity toward the great of this world. And I always came to the same conclusion, that all in all, I was the greatest.
Michael thus went back to Poland, arriving back at his adoptive parents' house when he was 21 years old, so this would be about 1938. He arrived home an hour before his father would return from work so that he could work on his pious Catholic mother first, who Michael says would have been about 53 years old at this time. But Michael says,
she had aged very much and had no makeup on her face. She seemed ill. She began to tremble, then started to cry.
And Michael had some rather discriminatory attitudes towards women.
Women are really where they belong when they are in harems, where men visit them only in case of absolute necessity.
So, discrimination much? He apologized for not communicating with her in 6 years and immediately started telling her about his desire to become a priest. He said that he had received a private revelation of St. Anthony of Padua with the little child Jesus in his arms, something he thought his mother would believe even though his father would not. He figured that playing his parents off each other would somehow strengthen his position. The next day, he asked to see the bishop about his vocation.
The bishop requested that I present myself to the pastor of my parish and also to a religious noted for having the gift of mind reading. This gibberish simply meant that this good man was capable of detecting false vocations from the simply imaginary to the frankly perverse.
Michael's visit with the pastor went well, and the pastor was enthusiastic about having a vocation in his parish. His visit with the religious also seemed to go quite well.
Of course, I manifested the most exquisite modesty. It is indeed a self-styled virtue very easy to imitate. It is even a very amusing game. And I was an ace at modesty, as well as many other acts.
But he was shocked when he was called back to the bishop's house and informed that the religious did not think that he had a vocation. He sent a letter to Russia indicating that the plan had hit an obstacle in the form of the religious, and he received a note back saying, suppress the obstacle. So he met again with the religious.
I told him that I could even take away his life if I could by that gesture succeed in entering the seminary. He answered that he knew it. Then and there, I was truly stupefied. And we remained silent a long while, looking at each other. And again he spoke, saying, you do not know what you are doing. Then I got up and caused death without wounds. Men of my worth have all the chance of undergoing a special training whose precious secrets come from Japan.
You see, Michael had been trained in Japanese killing arts, and he's apparently learned a reported technique that allows you to kill without leaving a mark. This may have been the reported touch of death move that is rumored to exist. In Chinese, it's sometimes called dim mak, which means press artery. And there's a variant known as vibrating palm. But whatever version Michael used came from Japan, and it caused the religious to die of an apparent heart failure. But Michael did pay a price for using this technique.
The next day, my body was covered in pimples. I was furious because it was a sign of weakness, a sign that my liver could not support such tension. I was stupid. But I congratulated myself because my father thought that I was really suffering on account of not entering the seminary. And he took pains to go plead my cause with the bishop. With success.
This year, 1938, Michael was coming up with really good ideas to fight religion. even before going to seminary. He writes,
"It would do some good that a prophecy be sent throughout the world that would be the following. Someday you will see married priests and mass said in vernacular tongues. I remember with joy that I was the first one to say these things in 1938. That same year, I urged women to ask for the priesthood. And I advocated a mass, not a parish mass, but a family mass that would be said at home by the father and mother before each meal. Ideas crowded into my head, each one more exciting than the one before it."
So Michael was the first one in 1938 to propose married priests and translating the liturgy from Latin into vernacular languages like English, Spanish, and Polish. Michael then got ready to go to seminary and start studying for the priesthood, but he didn't end up going overseas for seminary. Instead, he ended up going to Rome.
"In Rome, I had very interesting conversations with a professor who would be mine when I would have received the priesthood. He was a member of our network. He was very optimistic. He had specialized in Holy Scripture and was working at a new translation of the Bible in English. The most astounding thing was that he had chosen a Lutheran pastor as his only collaborator. The said pastor, besides, was no longer in agreement with his own church, which seemed old-fashioned to him. The professor also taught me a reasonable way to say Mass, since in 6 years I would be obliged to say it. While waiting for a profound modification of the whole ceremony, he never pronounced the words of the consecration. But so, as not to be suspected, he pronounced words almost similar, at least according to the ending of the words in Latin. He advised me to do the same. All that made the ceremony look like a sacrifice should, little by little, be suppressed. The whole ceremony should represent only a common meal, as among Protestants. He even assured me that it should never have been otherwise. He also worked at the elaboration of a new ordinary of the Mass and advised me also to do the same, because it appeared to him to be altogether desirable to present to people a large number of diversified Masses.
Now that he was embarked on his seminary studies, Michael made a real impression.
"Everyone wished to show sympathy to the courageous young Polish man. The glory of God was more worthy to me than of my country, they would say. What holiness! With modesty, I let them speak. I had promised myself to be the first in everything, and it was so. My knowledge of living languages was really prodigious. This is, after all, common to Orientals. I worked with stubbornness on Latin and Greek."
But things were going a little too smoothly for Michael, so he decided to mix things up. Specifically, he decided to make a full confession to a priest that he refers to as Blue Eyes, presumably not Frank Sinatra.
"I wanted to find out how he would act to keep the secret of confession and at the same time to make use of it to have me dismissed. I did not think that it could be dangerous for me because I could always deny everything. Moreover, I was the first in all things and therefore in very good standing. I was visibly the most intelligent of the whole crowd. So I begged Blue Eyes to hear my confession. And I related everything to him, at least the essentials. That I was a communist, attached to the Secret Service section of militant atheism. That I had murdered a Polish religious who pretended that I had no vocation to the priesthood. I was obliged to explain clearly to him that I neither believed in God nor in the devil. Such a confession was probably something new to him. I almost pitied him."
Yet Blue Eyes did not turn Michael in. But Michael was still bored, so he decided to mix things up even more.
"I therefore confessed myself successfully to all the professors. Then I amused myself, imagining them turning this horrible secret in their minds. But I could never understand how they could bear the burden of my presence among them and of the vision of all the wrong that I could do. Nevertheless, on some days I was delightfully worried. I needed this stimulant. I imagined that they would find some way to prevent me from receiving holy orders. Then I redoubled my zeal. My sermons were models, little masterpieces.
However, Michael still continued to be unhappy much of the time, and by 1940, with World War II in its second year in Europe, he found himself thinking this way.
At the end of 2 years of seminary life, I was seriously asking myself if I could keep up with it. The will that exercises itself alone is not always sufficient, and I was very young to feed myself only on my hatred. Nevertheless, I saw this hatred increase, and at first reserved for God, it now extended to all of my surroundings. If only they could have guessed what degree I hated them all. Even today, I admire myself able to tolerate them.
And at this point, Michael was presented with a new temptation. While at a grand reception, he spied a young woman that he refers to as Raven Hair. This was, of course, because she had black hair, which was quite long. She was a Catholic woman from France, and it's important to note that at this reception, Michael was not dressed as a seminarian, so Raven Hair had no idea that he was studying for the priesthood. Instead, she just thought he was this rich Polish dude. But Michael was instantly smitten with her and fell head over heels in love.
I spoke with Raven Hair for a few moments during which I could not eat her all up, because what was dominating my inner self was the desire to take this young girl all for myself and to hide her in a small house, far from all, a little house in which she would promise to wait for me. She had very large, dark eyes that looked at you with an embarrassing seriousness. And when she was invited to dance by other men, I had to hold both my hands behind my back in order not to kill the one who took her away from me. I must succeed in getting her to wish nothing else but to wait for me. Any means would be good to attain this end. She belonged to me, that's all. I had taken the decision of directing her thoughts because I considered that she belonged to me forever.
So, really serious case of love at first sight that zooms immediately into the creepy and manipulative. You know, I mean, if you love somebody, set them free. Don't take them to a cabin and lock them up and determine that they're yours forever on the night you meet them and that you need to direct their thoughts. Creepy obsession much? One day, as Michael was getting together with Raven Hair, he hit a bit of a speed bump in their relationship.
The woman of my dreams wore, on that day, a very simple blue dress and had around her neck just one jewel, a large medal of the Virgin, called the Miraculous Medal. My eyes kept returning all the time to that object and were scorched by it. I would have liked to snatch it away from her and throw it out the window.
And her wearing the miraculous medal would become something of an issue. However, it was not long after Michael's third meeting with her that Hitler invaded France. The Battle of France began on May 10th, 1940, and it was over 6 weeks later, by June 25th of the same year, so the French had unfortunately lost hard. The miraculous medal also kept being a sore spot in Michael's relationship with Ravenhair. She sensed a certain distance between them and asked what the cause of it was.
I hesitated a long while, and I decided to risk everything with her by pointing at the medal that she wore on her neck. She looked at me with great surprise. "Don't you have the faith?" she asked simply. I said no, without adding anything else. She implored me to explain the effect that the medal produced on me. I answered her, "It is an obstacle in the sense that it represents something which we will never be able to love together." While she was thinking this over, I insisted, saying, "Moreover, it seems on purpose to come between us two in order that we might never belong to one another."
Now, this illustrates a difference between Raven Hair and myself. if I was interested in someone and they said they did not have the faith, it would be game over. I mean, you have to assume that, especially early in a romance, the other person is going to be on their best behavior and that you'll see more of their real self over time. It's foolish to think that someone will change for you, and even more foolish to think that you will change them. The best you can hope for is a slow maturation that will hopefully occur over time. So if at the beginning of a relationship, someone told me they didn't even have the faith, I'd discontinue the relationship. However, that's not what Ravenhair did.
Then she took off the medal and gave it to me. I put it in my pocket, asking myself what I would do with it. By this gesture, she had united our two destinies in a very strange manner. She was tactful enough not to ask me what I was going to do with it. In the following days, I had some anxiety about this subject. I had the temptation to get some information about this thing, which bore the qualifier miraculous. Not that I could believe that this ornament had the power to perform miracles. According to me, nobody performs miracles. Those that are narrated as such are either invented or will later be scientifically explained. Nevertheless, I read that this medal was reputed to have brought back unbelievers to the faith. I did not believe in the reality of this fact, nor even, of course, in its possibility. But I feared that my dear friend had this hope in her heart.
Michael thus thought that Ravenhair had given him the medal in hopes of converting him, and when he asked her about this, she confessed it freely.
"I never lie," she said. "Surely I want that medal to bring about your conversion. I ask that favor every night and morning, my poor dear. And also many times a day, maybe at every quarter of an hour." I did not know how to answer.
As the conversation continued, an alarming development occurred. Michael became enraged and writes,
"I do not know what prevented me from raping her at that very moment. She will never know how close she came to it."
Yikes! Anyway, Ravenhair's devotion to the Blessed Mother and the miraculous medal may have turned his thoughts towards destroying Marian devotions. For example, he decided it was essential to destroy the rosary.
"This devotion, which professes to honor 15 so-called mysteries, must be vigorously destroyed. It is capable, all by itself, of maintaining and propagating the faith in a triune God. As for all other things, it will be necessary to make all those who keep on reciting the rosary feel guilty. Such is the summary of my orders, which I sent throughout the world at the time when, in my seminarian's room, I had hung up on the picture of the one I could never marry, the medal spoken of as miraculous."
So, despite sending orders throughout the world to destroy the rosary, Michael hung up the miraculous medal in his room over a picture of Ravenhair. But Michael also had a communist buddy named Ashiel, who was his singing professor.
"I could not refrain from telling him the whole story about the medal. I was dumbfounded by his answer. He told me, 'Beware. All that is said about that medal is true. If you have it in your room, you are in danger.' I asked him if he had a fever. He pretended not to hear, but the very sight of this medal made him sick, and he could never bear its presence without becoming wild. The human heart is an incomprehensible chasm. That my old professor, an ardent communist, could speak in such a manner worried me greatly. For the first time in my life, I had doubts about the success of my mission. I wanted to discuss it with him, but to no avail. Ashiel answered me, 'I believe in nothing, neither in God nor in the devil, much less in the Virgin Mary. But I am afraid of that medal, that's all.'"
Michael then decided that he needed to make Ashiel confront his irrational fear of the miraculous medal.
"On the following Saturday, before going to visit Ravenhair, I went by Ashiel's house with a hammer, a nail, the medal, and its chain. Without allowing him to discuss it, I went straight into his room. I hammered the nail at the head of his bed where the crucifix is often placed, and I hung on it the miraculous medal.
At this point, something startling occurred. His communist buddy, Professor Ashiel, suddenly moved away, despite the fact that he had an established position in Rome, and apparently without any orders from the Soviet Union, he suddenly up and moved, apparently because of his fear of the miraculous medal, and Michael never learned what happened to him. We now move up to 1941, Michael's third year of seminary, and he and Ravenhair were going through a bit of a rough patch. He'd revealed to her that he had no faith, and she continued to be interested in him anyway and was praying for his conversion. But she told him that they shouldn't see each other for a while, and it wasn't always super easy for him to be away from her.
I was strongly tempted to see Ravenhair again. I cared too much. This was not fitting for a militant communist, still less for a future grand chief of the party. I had already gone through 3 years of seminary life. Only three more remained. After that, everyone agreed that I would be sent to Rome to undertake higher studies. Then I think I would myself become a professor, probably a professor in a seminary.
In the same period, 1941, Michael was still working on his anti-religion projects. He had written a model for a future catechism that he imagined would suit the circumstances around the year 2000. He wanted to stress the priority of following one's own conscience over following church teachings. He wanted to have less formal language in prayers and translations. He wanted to have baptism conferred only on adults and not children. He wanted the sacrament of penance replaced by communal penance services at Easter and Christmas. He wanted to change the name of extreme unction to the sacrament of the sick. And he wanted the doctrine of the Trinity denounced as offensive to Jews and Muslims. So he had lots of good ideas.
I see all that an intelligent man would derive from this. Truly, I do not know whence comes all that I invent, but I am a man of genius. I feel genius coming out through all the pores of my skin.
But not everyone did, including Ravenhair.
During all these long weeks, Ravenhair did not invite me to return to her shop. I was fuming with rage when one day I met the girl whom I considered mine in the corridors of the university. She had decided to follow courses in ancient art. She stopped to tell me that she was preparing an answer to my plan for a new catechism, hoping to be able to discuss it with me quietly. To discuss. I was not in the habit of meeting the least obstacle to the ways in which I launched my ideas. But I answered her that the pleasure of meeting her was so strong in me that I could not refuse her desire to talk. Nevertheless, I promised myself to let her know that a woman who is really in love, even without noticing it, should adopt all the opinions of the man that her heart has chosen.
Well, Ravenhair didn't adopt all his opinions, and the book's next-to-last chapter is devoted to a letter that she wrote him that began this way.
Darling, thank you for the confidence which you have shown me and which incites me to open my heart completely to you. What does this heart say? That it loves you, and you know it. You know it only too well. It seems to me that your heart desires to have me share all your ideas, but I do not have this pretension. I only want to cry out to you, beware, there lies a death trap.
During the course of the letter, she says this.
My poor darling, you are too intelligent. Moreover, you received a shock in your childhood. I do not ask you what kind. Have you not reached the age of looking upon the past with a serene soul? It seems to me that unconsciously you are seeking revenge. Is this a noble attitude? You were a very pious boy until you reached 14 years of age, you told me. So that all my letter is asking you is to think. You know that.
And the letter concludes.
Darling, I would prefer that you never loved me on this earth, rather than to know that you are, for all eternity, in that place where tears never dry. for I love you.
Then, in the last chapter, Michael explains how he responded to her letter.
I answered Ravenhair's letter by an increase in anti-apostolic zeal. At that time, when we were nearing the end of this stupid war, I prepared a large number of attacks, for which I expected complete victory in a maximum of 30 years. I was musing about the year 1974 when I thought that I could celebrate the birth of a universal church without God. My hatred for the supernatural not only gave me genius, but also unbelievable strength from my double work. For let us not forget, I was studying theology, and it was very important that I should get good grades. In fact, I was the best at everything.
But as he was in the midst of these activities, he got a message from Ravenhair. She wanted to see him.
On a Saturday, when the sun was shining very brightly, I charged at top speed into the shop where Ravenhair was waiting for me. Who will ever be able to understand the meaning of those ordinary words, Ravenhair is waiting for me? Ravenhair was so completely mine that I would have liked to cut her hair so that no one else could see it. Cut it? What a criminal idea came into my mind. She was all sweetness and love when she told me that she had a request to make. I almost trembled. But all that she wanted was simply to draw my hands, which are, they say, admirable. Truly, women have some absurd, though charming, ideas.
You see, Ravenhair was an artist, and she had previously painted Michael's portrait, but now she wanted to sketch his admirable hands. After she did so, they arranged to meet again the next Saturday, but afterwards, Michael realized he'd made a mistake. He was scheduled to go on a retreat the next Saturday and receive ordination a few days after that. We're now in 1944, the end of Michael's sixth year of seminary. And remember, Ravenhair does not know that he's studying for the priesthood. She just thinks he's some rich Polish atheist dude who writes catechisms in his free time. So he wrote Ravenhair a letter and made up an excuse. But when he entered the chapel, it isn't clear whether for his retreat or his ordination, he saw something that surprised him.
I saw young men lifting a fainted girl. Her mantilla had fallen, and her long black hair was disarranged and was dragging on the floor of the chapel. When I lifted my eyes to turn them away from this scene, I met the keen look of the professor who had acted as my mailbox for contacting members of the Communist spy network. What was he doing there? Was he the one who had brought Ravenhair? During the short exchange of looks, I thought that I read in this man the expression of a cruel triumph.
So one of Michael's colleagues brought Ravenhair to the service, revealing to her that Michael was about to be ordained priest and causing her to faint.
During the following days, I prepared my trip to the USA, where I wanted to visit the most important Protestant sects in order to find out how to control them. Until then, forcibly, I had been obliged to neglect too much the important factor of faith so solidly anchored in the Protestant world. It was imperative that I should know well this aspect of the problem before going on to continue my studies in Rome. Just before my departure, the student came running to tell me the news which would make me suffer the most. The entrance of Ravenhair into a Carmelite monastery. She was there for my sake. Never any more would she have the least lover's joy. For my sake.
So even though she had viewed Michael as a rich Polish atheist dude who wrote heretical catechisms in his free time, Ravenhair loved him so much that she decided to enter a Carmelite monastery in order to offer her life as a perpetual sacrifice for his conversion. Michael responded by making plans to destroy monasteries of nuns, causing them to stop dressing in habits and become ineffective in supporting and spreading the faith. Michael's work went on for some years, and he wasn't particularly happy much of the time.
My work was functioning at a rather monotonous pace when rumors concerning the possible opening of a universal council came to stimulate my zeal.
So this takes us up to about the summer of 1958, when Pope John XXIII announced plans for an upcoming council.
I learned that some schemas were being prepared by order of the Pope. I convinced my superiors that maybe a definitive role could be played. I was then appointed to the highest post.
So Michael was then appointed to some super high post, though he doesn't say what it was.
Everything depended on me, and my funds were practically unlimited. I financed leftist reviews and also a large number of journalists who performed excellent work afterwards. All my hopes laid principally on alternate schemas which I had suggested through much advanced and audacious theologians. I think that ambition guided them. It is the most powerful of driving forces. I succeeded in obtaining copies of all the official schemas, I mean those commanded by the Pope. They were, for me, catastrophic, absolutely calamitous, and I weigh my words. Suppose that these schemas were edited and widely circulated, and all my work would be set back to zero, or almost.
What Michael's referring to here is that prior to the council, Pope John had a bunch of drafts, or preparatory schema, as they were called, written for documents that the council could issue. And there were a ton of them, drafts of like 70 documents in all. They were prepared by commissions that were headed by the corresponding dicasteries at the Vatican. And the commissions that prepared them were quite conservative. For example, the preparatory commission with the responsibility for drafting theological documents was headed by Cardinal Alfredo Ottaviani, who was the prefect of the Holy Office, today called the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, and he was a very conservative dude. So it's understandable that Michael would be alarmed at the idea of the Council Fathers lightly modifying and then approving these highly conservative draft documents. He thus began to prepare alternative drafts.
Finally, thanks to my zeal, and especially to the money which I spent as if it were inexhaustible, the modernist schemas, oh, very timidly modernist, I must confess, were brought in secretly to the council and presented with audacity to replace the official ones, about which they complained for not having been worked out in full liberty, the holy liberty of the children of God, as they say. This sleight-of-hand trick filled the whole assembly with such stupefaction that they have not yet gotten over it and will never be able to, which proves that audacity always pays.
What Michael is referring to here is that when the council actually met, the council fathers objected to the schemas that were presented to them. They were like, hey, we didn't come here just to ratify a bunch of pre-prepared documents you drafted here at the Vatican with only minor changes. If this is an ecumenical council, then we as bishops need to be involved in a substantial way in the creation of the documents. And so the preliminary schemas were retracted and the council fathers got busy drafting new ones. Michael continues.
Nevertheless, I am not satisfied. No, this council was not what I was hoping for. We will have to wait for Vatican III. There we will gain a complete victory. As for Vatican II, I do not know what happened. It seemed as if an invisible devil would stop all of our efforts of modernization. Just at the moment they would have become efficacious. Strange and maddening.
So, yeah, Vatican II was not the modernist triumph that some wanted it to be. Fortunately, things were looking up for Michael in the years after the council.
Happily, since then we have found the astuteness which consists in hiding behind the spirit of the council to launch all kinds of thrilling innovations. This expression, spirit of the council, has become for me a master trump. As for me, it is like playing a game of cards. I cut and overcut, or I play the master trump, which enables me to pick up the last little hearts, the small non-silvery clubs, and the disarmed little spades. But it will only be at Vatican III that I will be able to present myself with hammer and nails, not to nail God on his cross, but rather to nail him in his coffin.
And that's the note on which the manuscript ends. Michael was disappointed with Vatican II. It didn't deliver nearly what he wanted, But he was hopeful that a Vatican III would finally create his religion-undermining communist utopia. However, he would not live to see it, for as the prologue of the book revealed, he apparently died following a car accident before 1972. Now, we need to ask the question, how much of this is actually true?
And before we answer the question, we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make this show possible, including Mary S., Mary H., Rachel H., Joseph G., and Chris D. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is also brought to you by DeliverContacts.com, offering top brand contact lenses at always low prices with free delivery. Visit DeliverContacts.com. And by Tim Shevlin's Personal Fitness Training for Catholics, providing spiritual and physical wellness programs and daily accountability check-ins. Strengthen yourself to help further God's kingdom. Work out for the right reason with the right mindset. Learn more by visiting fitcatholics.com. So, Jimmy, what theories are there about the book AA 1025, Memoirs of an Anti-Apostle?
Well, one prominent theory is that it's absolutely true. There really was a communist infiltrator corresponding to Michael. He really was responsible for all the problems in the church that he claims credit for. He really did write his memoirs, and he really did die following a car accident. A step down from that theory is one that says, okay, maybe Michael wasn't real, but something like this must have happened. Communist infiltrators were responsible for the described problems in the church. And then there's the theory that basically none of this is true, that the whole story is basically bunk, although that's not the same thing as saying that there was no communist infiltration.
Before we get to the reason perspective, what can we say about AA 1025 from the faith perspective?
Well, let's see. Communism bad. Infiltrating the priesthood under false pretenses bad. Trying to undermine the faith bad. Plenty of badness here to go around on the assumption that the story's true. On the other hand, if the story isn't true, then peddling false stories is true bad. Feeding unnecessary paranoia on the part of the faithful, bad. So there's some badness on this side of the equation, too. Further, whether the story is true or not, there's one more aspect of badness that applies to both scenarios. The list of things that Michael takes credit for proposing in the book just isn't all that bad. Not the stuff that actually happened. I mean, take, for example, translating the liturgy into vernacular languages like English and Polish and stuff. Now, I'm a big fan of Latin. I've studied Latin. I attend a mass that has Gregorian chant in Latin, and I sing the regular Gregorian chant parts in Latin. I recognize that there are some advantages to having a mass in a common language like Latin, particularly in mixed language congregations. And I support the saying of the Latin liturgy, both in its traditional pre-Vatican II form and in its current form. But there's nothing magic about Latin. It's not that the liturgy has to be celebrated in Latin. It wasn't celebrated in Latin in the beginning, but in Aramaic and then in Greek. And even in Rome, it wasn't originally celebrated in Latin, but in Greek. And languages like Aramaic and Greek, among others, continue to be used in various rites within the church. There are also advantages to saying Mass in the vernacular so that people who aren't fluent in Latin can understand it and be more mentally engaged with it. What language you celebrate the liturgy in and how much of it you use which languages for thus has trade-offs, and different proposals are reasonably possible. So we shouldn't portray vernacular languages as intrinsic horrors. They're just not.
Then let's switch to the reason perspective. What can we say about AA 1025 from this point of view?
Well, let's start with the proposal that the story is 100% true and see what we can say in favor of it. The publisher, Tan Books, has an introductory note in which they offer arguments for this view. They essentially make 5 arguments, so we'll cover them one by one and then consider them. The first argument is this.
According to the original French publisher at Edition San Raphael, the story as she tells it is essentially true and the way it happened.
However, she did apparently do some slight editing of the text to make it more readable.
So the first argument is that the original publisher says the story is true. The second argument is...
Nonetheless, there is obviously a strong difference in style between Mary Carey's prologue and her interjected editorial comment on pages 79 to 83, on the one hand, and the text itself on the other, which is a strong indication that the story was written by someone else.
The second argument is that there is a strong difference of style between the portions of the book that Marie Carey wrote and those attributed to Michael, so that more than one person wrote this. The third argument is...
Also, there is evidence of authenticity in the memoirs themselves, which discuss a matter that did not take place until approximately 1980 to 1983, namely, the adulation given to Martin Luther in various quarters in the church. This especially leading up to the 500th centennial of his birth in 1983. It is not reasonable to imagine that a nurse, or anyone else for that matter, could have predicted in 1971 or 1972 that various people in the Catholic Church would, within 10 years, be extolling Martin Luther as some sort of religious hero.
The third argument is that nobody in 1971 or 1972 could have predicted Catholics extolling Luther as a sort of religious hero within a decade. The fourth argument is...
Even if this book were pure fabrication from beginning to end, nonetheless, what it claims to prognosticate has actually come true, unerringly so.
So the fourth argument is that even if the book is a fabrication, what it predicts has unerringly come to pass. And the fifth and final argument is...
Besides this, moreover, all the many profound and even revolutionary changes that have occurred within the Catholic Church since Vatican Council I, 1962 to 1965, had to have been conceived in the minds of people intimately familiar with the workings of the Catholic Church, and also had to have been promoted by such people through the influential channels within the Church, or they never would have been accepted and put into place.
The fifth argument is that the changes that have happened in the Catholic Church since 1965 had to be planned and promoted by influential people in the church.
Now, let's go back through those arguments and consider them. What do you make of the first argument that the original French publisher said the story was substantially true, except for minor edits of Michael's manuscript that Marie Carey made to make it more readable?
I don't care about the minor edits that she made. Manuscripts do need to be edited before they're published, so I expect things like that to happen in popularly published books. You know, this isn't a trial document where making edits would be evidence tampering, or an academic text where edits would not be expected. I just don't think minor edits are a big deal, and I wouldn't criticize the story on that basis. The real issue is whether the French publisher claims that the story is true. There is actually an issue connected with this that we'll come back to. However, an additional question is, exactly what did the French publisher say? Lots of publishers come out with books in their nonfiction category, which implies that they're essentially true. But it sometimes turns out that these books aren't true and that the publisher made a mistake. So I'd like to know specifically what the French publisher said. I'd like to see an exact quotation that describes the links to which they went to verify the story. In other words, how does the publisher know that the story is essentially true? Did they just take Marie Carey's word for it, or did they do fact-checking, and how much fact-checking? Only certain parts of the story can be fact-checked. They could, for example, verify that Marie Carey was a nurse during the relevant time frame. They could verify where she worked and thus where Michael would have died. They could have looked at Michael's name unknown John Doe death certificate and verify that someone died under these circumstances. They could have verified that when he arrived at the hospital, Michael's possessions included a 100-page manuscript. And they could have verified that Marie Carey now had that manuscript, which they could have examined the original of, you know, without Carey's minor editorial changes. Yet we are given no indication that any such checking was done. For all we know, the publisher just took Carey's word. But then there are the parts of the story that can't be verified. Suppose that everything we just mentioned checked out. You know, Caray was a nurse in the right time period. She was at the hospital for the death of a John Doe following an auto accident, who did have a 100-page manuscript, and it's the one she based her book manuscript on. Let's grant all of that. Even so, how do we know that the manuscript is true? Michael's true name is nowhere in the manuscript, neither is his adoptive name. And he didn't have any identification papers on him. So how do we know he was a Catholic priest of Polish origin? Much less, how do we know he did all the things the manuscript describes? Maybe he was an aspiring author who had what he thought was a good idea for a Catholic spy story. And then he wrote the manuscript intending it to be published as a work of fiction, but got into a car crash. Or maybe he was a delusional nut job who invented a self-aggrandizing fantasy life story for himself. Or maybe he was a communist agent who wanted to cause problems in the Catholic Church by falsely claiming credit for everything that many believed had gone wrong, and then he got into a car accident. Bottom line, if we don't have a way to investigate Michael's part of the story, we don't have a way of establishing its truth. So even if the French publisher extensively fact-checked Caray's part of the story, we don't have proof that the story of the manuscript itself is true. You'd have to do additional checking for that.
What do you make of the Tan Books' second argument that there's a difference between the parts of the book written by Caray and the parts reportedly written by Michael?
Well, there are two such parts. The first is the prologue, which we quoted from earlier, and the second is an interruption in chapter 13, in which the nurse gives a long series of complaints involving priests and changes in the liturgy and church law. She's quite impassioned about this and begs the editor and the reader's pardon for such an emotive expression. When comparing these passages to the parts of the book reportedly written by Michael, I would say several things. First, and granting this is all in translation, not the original French, but first, this is an entirely subjective claim. There is a way to give at least a degree of objectivity to it, which would be to take the French originals of both texts and do a stylometric comparison of them. Stylometry is a discipline that looks at aspects of text style statistically, like how often an author uses certain words, how often he uses conjunctions, how long his sentences are, what type of structure the sentences have, and so on. The proposal is that you can sometimes figure out whether a person did or didn't write two texts by looking at the stylometric statistics. Personally, I think that stylometry is iffy and still in its early stage of development as an investigative technique, but doing such an analysis on the text here would give us at least some added degree of objectivity as opposed to an impression that's just purely subjective. However, we don't have stylometry on these texts. Second, I would have to say that I personally don't find the style that different. In fact, I was struck by how similar the style of the nurse passages are with the style of the spy passages. For example, they both have a conflicted writing style where they engage in internal debates, like the nurse being conflicted and debating in the text whether she would publish the manuscript, and the spy being conflicted between his mission and his love for Ravenhair. They both also think in terms of black and white, things being really right or really wrong. They both have a florid, complicated writing style that includes lots of unnecessary material and digressions. They both include wandering stream of consciousness elements. They both approach or can approach subjects obliquely rather than head on. They both use a notable number of poetic flourishes, and they both have super dramatic, super emotive writing styles. So speaking as an author who thinks a lot about writing styles, I just don't see them as being that stylistically different. Third, even to the extent that they are stylistically different, this is something a competent author can do. Competent authors can vary their writing style to suit different characters. In fact, it's regarded as a sign of bad writing if an author doesn't make their characters sound different from each other. If they all talk exactly the same, it's regarded as the mark of an inexperienced or unskilled author. So I don't think the second argument from Tan Publishers has significant force.
What about the third argument, that nobody in 1971 or 1972 could have predicted Catholics extolling Luther as a sort of religious hero within a decade?
Oh, this one makes me want to ask, where were you in 72? By that point, as the book notes, the whole Spirit of Vatican II thing was on the lips of progressive theologians, and there was a push to warm relationships with Lutherans, and the progressives were already saying positive things, including some very positive things about Luther in hopes of reconciliation. And you didn't have to be a super progressive. There was at the time a serious proposal to attempt reunification with Lutherans on the basis of a Catholic reading of the Lutheran Augsburg Confession. This was seriously entertained by theologians, including Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI. And while he ultimately decided that the proposal was too starry-eyed, even someone like him was giving it serious thought. In all the reconciliation mania and new ecumenism joy that was in the air at the time, the idea that some Catholics would portray Luther in a extra positive light in the run-up to the 500th anniversary of his birth was not unpredictable. It was easily predictable.
What about the fourth argument, that even if the book is a complete fabrication, what it predicts has unerringly come to pass?
This argument is better handled in conjunction with the second hypothesis that we need to consider, which is that something like this must have happened, even if the story in the book is false. So we'll consider this argument later.
And finally, what about the fifth argument, that the changes that have happened in the Catholic Church since 1965 had to be planned and promoted by influential people in the church?
Well, it's true. Changes don't happen in the Catholic Church without Catholics planning and promoting them. And the more significant the changes are, the more influential some of those people need to be. But so what? That doesn't prove that any of the relevant people were communist spies or American spies or Freemasonic spies or Nazi spies or any kind of spies. That influential Catholics promoted further changes in the church after Vatican II is hardly a newsflash, and it doesn't prove that they were the result of a communist plot, much less that they were the result of a single spy like Michael, who was supposed to be orchestrating them. I thus think that the arguments for the truth of the story proposed by Tan Books are exceptionally weak.
Then let's look at the other side of the argument. Do you see reasons to doubt the authenticity of the story?
Yes, and lots of them. Many, though not all of these, have to do with implausibilities connected with the story. Now, the way I wrote this episode, Dom, you would have had a lot of reading to do up to this point in the episode, and I was going to say now it's my turn to be long-winded, but you ducked out and got Rob Mady to do the reading for this episode. And I'm still stuck, so here we go. We'll start with the creation of the manuscript of the memoirs themselves. First, Michael describes himself as a redoubtable secret agent, meaning a formidable and thus very competent one. Well, competent secret agents do not write memoirs while they are in the field. I mean, maybe after they retire, but not in the field, because people might discover the memoirs when they're not expecting this to happen, and that would cause them to be exposed as a spy, which is allegedly exactly what happened in this case. So this is why you don't write memoirs in the field. Now, let's move on to Michael's early life. Second, it is implausible that Michael's first memory would be of walking along a road at 3 years of age. We all have childhood amnesia that sets in when we're between 5 and 7 years old, so that we don't remember things from very early childhood. We may have flashes of memory from before that time. In fact, I have flashes of memory from before age 5. But they're extremely brief and lack detail. What's especially problematic about Michael's first memory is that he remembers his proficiency in 3 different languages. He says he barely spoke Polish, his Russian was worse, and he didn't appear to understand German. It is very unlikely, following the onset of childhood amnesia, that as an adult, he would have this kind of detailed memory about his language proficiency at age 3. Although, perhaps someone told him about his language proficiency at a later age. A third implausibility is the worry his adoptive parents had about his passport when he was 14 years old and they were planning a trip to Rome and Paris to celebrate Michael's academic success. Michael said that they were worried about his passport saying he was not their son. Well, it certainly would raise questions at the border if your passport showed that you were transporting a child that was not yours across international boundaries. But why would Michael's passport say that? It's implausible that it would say anything like that unless his super well-off, super pious Catholic parents had failed to adopt him. If they'd adopted him, his passport should be consistent with him being legally their son. And if his parents implausibly had not adopted him, why would he have a passport at all? How did they file the forms to get it? It's implausible that they would have been able to obtain a passport for him if he wasn't legally their son. And why wouldn't it just list him as having their name, even if they'd never formally adopted him? And it wouldn't have had his birth name on it because Michael says he couldn't say his birth name anymore when he was found, so he didn't know it. So we have a network of implausibilities here. Then, fourth, there's the implausibility of the sudden hatred of his parents and corresponding abandonment of his faith. Michael says that before this point, he loved his adoptive parents a great deal, and he was extremely sincere and devout in his Catholic faith. But upon hearing his parents' conversation about his passport, he suddenly came to hate his parents and their faith. But why? He's given us no indication that he didn't know he was adopted. In fact, he records his memory of being age 3 and meeting his adoptive parents. So this should not have come like a thunderbolt, as he says. And he would have no reason to conclude that his adoptive parents had been lying to him, which he says is what he did conclude. So this is very implausible unless the manuscript simply fails to communicate what actually happened. Fifth, there's the implausibility of his going to Russia. Even granting that he made a sudden decision to run away from home, why would he suddenly decide to go to Russia? And even if he had, it's implausible that he would have found the woman who was willing to break the law to help him get there. And it's implausible that anyone, especially a 14-year-old boy, could have gotten to Russia in this time period for reasons we'll cover. When he gets to Leningrad, he makes contact with his friend's uncle, which is not implausible, and the uncle helps him get a communist education, which is also not implausible. But then after that education, the uncle gives him a covert assignment. So seventh, it's implausible that a local police official like the uncle would have assigned him to go undercover in the West and become a Catholic priest. That is not the kind of assignment a local police officer, even one who was an intelligence agent, would be handing out. That kind of assignment should have required the involvement of and come from someone else in the Soviet intelligence system. Eighth, it's implausible that a 20-year-old boy would have been given such an assignment, partly because it was meant to be a lifetime of undercover work, and 20-year-olds often have changes of mind, especially if they're living off in the decadent West and seeing everything the West has to offer them. They're too unreliable to be trusted with that kind of mission. They can easily turn and expose your whole operation. Ninth, it's implausible that they'd send 1,024 previous men to become Catholic seminarians before Michael. That number is much too high. Out of the 1,024 previous young men, some would have certainly turned and given the program away. Tenth, it's implausible that Michael would never have contact with any of his 1,024 predecessors. Even with things compartmentalized, he should have had contact with some of them because they'd encounter situations in the West where they needed to support each other and watch each other's backs. 11th, the whole rationale for his mission is problematic. It's one thing to commit acts of subversion in the West to undermine religion, but Michael says that he was sent into seminary to learn about religion so that they could figure out how to undermine it. And that's just goofy. The Soviets already understood religion. They could just read religious books and newspapers to understand Catholicism. In fact, he says they had a team monitoring Catholic publications, so they didn't need a wet behind the ears 20-year-old to go and learn about it and figure it out for them. Also, if they had already sent over 1,000 men into Catholic seminaries, then they wouldn't need Michael in particular to figure out Catholicism for them. Then 12th, there's how they get him into seminary, which is completely implausible. You don't just send someone back to their family after a 6-year absence and have him apply to go to seminary in just the few days that Michael says he did. That's way too quick and extremely suspicious. 13th, his order to kill the religious who said he didn't have a vocation is implausible. How does killing the guy get Michael into seminary? The man's death wouldn't change the fact that he's already told the bishop that Michael doesn't have a vocation. It could make sense to kill him before he delivered his opinion to the bishop, but the bishop already knew his opinion, so killing him wouldn't do anything. It would only risk exposing Michael. 14th, it's implausible that Michael would have taken training in Japanese death touch techniques. It's questionable whether the death touch even exists, and it's extremely implausible that Michael would have had a Japanese martial arts tutor, what with Japan being bitter enemies with Russia in this period. And it's implausible that closely held knowledge of the death touch would have been passed by the Japanese to the Soviets. 15th, once Michael gets into seminary, it's implausible that he would meet a communist professor who would teach him to say Mass without saying the words of consecration. An atheist secret agent would have no problem saying the words of consecration. He would just regard them as part of the magic mumbo jumbo that he's here to subvert, and he wouldn't attribute any further significance to them. 16th, what Michael says he begins to do while in seminary is completely implausible. Basically, he comes up with a list of things that reads like a checklist of traditionalist complaints of the post-conciliar church, and he thinks them all up by himself. He's the originator of them. Implausibly, just one guy thinks up basically everything that traditionalists have thought is wrong in the church now. Nobody else comes up with them, just Michael. 17th. Michael then gets them introduced through a network of 100 men that have been assigned to work for him, a man in his early 20s, and he implausibly doesn't meet any of the people working for him. 18th, it is totally improbable that the Soviets would approve this way of doing things. It involves an incredibly low level of decision making where you let a 20-something living in a foreign country at the lowest level of your intelligence system make all the strategic and tactical decisions for your program. This is not how Soviet decision making worked. People at or near the bottom had no autonomy in decision making. Their job was to carry out the orders and decisions of their superiors, and their superiors were not 20-somethings living in the West. They were older men living in Moscow. In fact, this decision-making process is still used in the Russian military, which is one of the reasons the Russians have been having such problems with their war in Ukraine. Their soldiers, unlike ours, aren't trained to assess their local circumstances, take initiative, and make decisions to accomplish the mission. They're trained to do the opposite and just carry out their superior's orders. The idea that Moscow would have authorized Michael to make the decisions for their Let's Undermine Religion project independently on foreign soil while in his early 20s is just crazy. It's also implausible that the Soviets would have entrusted Michael in particular with this task because the memoirs reveal Michael to be a total psychopathic megalomaniac with delusions of grandeur and a reckless delusional pattern of thinking, as we'll illustrate in a moment. Even if they weren't inside his head, his behavior should have given something of this away to his Soviet superiors, and it's implausible they would entrust him with this degree of authority. 19th. While in seminary, Michael decides to test the seal of confession by confessing to all his professors that he's a communist spy and an atheist sent to undermine Catholicism. It is extremely implausible that a spy would do this. In fact, it is recklessly suicidal. Even if the priests all regarded the seal as applying to this case, at least one of them might decide to brave temporary excommunication by revealing it for the good of the church. And to quote the Lord High Chancellor from Iolanthe, the subtleties of the legal mind are equal to the emergency. If Michael was a disbelieving atheist bent on undermining religion and revealed this fact to a priest to torture him, then he wasn't really a penitent seeking absolution. It could be argued that he was simulating the sacrament, in which case he wasn't actually engaging in the sacrament of confession, and thus the seal of confession would not apply. At least, that's how some of the priests he confessed to might regard the matter, in which case they would feel free to denounce him to their superiors as a communist spy. So it's implausible that Michael would have taken such a risk and that all the professors would have just let Michael continue on unaffected after this round of confessions. 20th, it's improbable that Michael would harbor ambitions, as he explicitly does, of being the grand chief of the Communist Party if he's planning to become a seminary professor and priest until his death, which was his assignment. Grand chiefs of the party do not work undercover in the West. They operate back home in Russia in the Politburo. 21st, it's implausible that Michael's fellow spy, Achille, would have reacted so fearfully towards the miraculous medal. An atheist who doesn't believe in religion and doesn't think it has any power shouldn't freak out and leave town after Michael nails it up in his residence. This reads more like low-quality Catholic fiction about how even atheists subconsciously recognize and are terrified by the power of the Virgin Mary. 22nd, while it's not implausible that Michael gets tempted to have a romance with Ravenhair, it is implausible that Ravenhair sticks with him and continues after she learns he's an atheist who writes heretical catechisms to undermine Catholicism in his free time. It's particularly implausible that once she learns he's being ordained a priest, that she decides to become a nun and go live in a monastery and sacrifice her life for his conversion. And it's totally implausible that she doesn't just go turn him into his bishop. After all, he's not a priest. She didn't hear his edit. After all, she's not a priest. She didn't hear his confession. She learned about his atheism and church subversion efforts out in the open. So why doesn't she just go and tell Michael's bishop what she knows about this man that he's about to ordain or has just ordained? It's completely implausible she wouldn't do that. 23rd, Michael's memoirs are apparently complete. He brings them to a literary conclusion, so they weren't cut off in mid-composition. It's thus implausible that he spends so much of his time covering the period that he was in seminary, which is almost the whole of the book. And he has only a tiny section at the end about his work during his career as a priest. The seminary period is just over 6 years, ending with his ordination in 1944. But he survived for several years after Vatican II ended, say until around 1970. So why does he just gloss over the final 26 years of his life, which should have been particularly fruitful for his work? I mean, that's when he got all his big changes made. And it was as a priest, you know, that he was in his best position to undermine the faith. So we should hear about that a lot more. 24th, the functioning of the Soviet intelligence service that Michael describes over the decades of his career as a spy is implausibly smooth. The system just seems to run like clockwork. Michael never has problems getting his messages. He never has disruptions regarding who his superiors are. And his orders always get flawlessly enacted, despite the fact that Russia was a very chaotic place in this period, with what's known as Stalin's Great Terror being between 1936 and 1939, in which Communist Party members were arrested and put on show trials, at least 750,000 people, 750,000, were executed in this period, and more than 1 million were sentenced to forced labor in the Gulag labor camps. So none of those people were in, and none of those executions and sentences affected Michael's superior and his network of spies back home. Later, after Stalin died, the reign of Nikita Khrushchev was also chaotic, with the de-Stalinization of the Communist Party, the Berlin crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the eventual forcing of Khrushchev from power by his underlings. Yet, implausibly, none of this has any effect on Michael's spy network. It's just smooth sailing the whole time. And Michael never mentions any difficulties caused by the chaos back home. 25th, Michael claims credit for writing the alternative drafts or schemas that were used at Vatican II. But this is implausible because we know the history of those drafts. We know who introduced them and how they were modified over time. In fact, there's an extensive set of volumes on the history of Vatican II documenting just these things. Further, Michael indicates that he didn't really have success with Vatican II, which he regarded as largely a failure on his part. So if he had somehow introduced all the alternative drafts, their original forms must have been very different from what the council approved. Yet the original drafts of the Vatican II documents that the bishops proposed weren't wildly different from what got published. They were different on some points, but they didn't support the kind of agenda that Michael hoped for and then get gutted by conservatives at the council. 26th, it's implausible that nobody has identified Michael, because his identity should be deducible. We know he was of Polish origin, at least for legal purposes. He was regarded in seminary as a Pole. He says that just before the council, he was elevated to the highest position, though he doesn't say in what. And we know that he died following a car crash around 1970. So what highly placed Polish priests died around 1970 following car crashes in the same country where Marie Curie worked? Or, since Michael wasn't carrying an ID card with him in the crash, what highly placed Polish priests mysteriously vanished around 1970? Either way, there shouldn't be that many of them, and it should be possible to look up their life stories and see which had an adoptive father who was a Polish medical doctor, who entered seminary around 1938, and who were ordained in 1944. Yet nobody's found a record of such a person, which is implausible if this is a real story. We've thus identified 26 different areas of implausibility connected with the story, and now I get to rest my voice for a moment.
Wow. So, Jimmy, you found the arguments presented in the Tan Books publisher's note unpersuasive, and you found numerous instances of implausibilities in the story it contains. Have other people identified problems with it?
They have. One such author is Sandra Miesel. In 2000, she wrote a piece in Crisis magazine titled "Swinging at Windmills: A Close Look at Catholic Conspiracy Theories." Most of the article is devoted to things besides AA 1025, but she devotes three paragraphs to the book. And one of the things she says is this:
the main character is a Polish orphan recruited by a Soviet spymaster between the world wars to penetrate and subvert the Catholic Church. This is supposed to explain post-Vatican II changes, although communist control never altered dogma or worship behind the Iron Curtain.
And I think that is a very important point. The churches that the Soviets would have the easiest time infiltrating and controlling were those in their own territories, yet they never tried to get these churches to change their doctrines or the way they worshiped. So if they didn't do that for the churches they could most readily influence, why would they try to do that for churches in the West? This is another serious implausibility. After Miesel's article, Alice von Hildebrand wrote a letter to the magazine in which she partially agreed with and partially took exception to Miesel. We'll quote from that letter when we get to the second theory we're considering, but Miesel published her own letter in response, and in that one she says,
In 1994, I wrote an article denouncing AA 1025. Having just reread it to write this rebuttal, I again draw on my training in history and experience writing and editing fiction to brand the book a fabrication, a piece of propaganda. No one ever wrote a memoir the way this book is written. Important events could not have occurred as described. The protagonist couldn't have crossed the sealed Polish-Russian border in 1931. He couldn't have been reporting to the same intelligence handler throughout the Russian purges, which are never mentioned, and World War II during the thousand-day siege of Leningrad. His account of meeting the spy chief contains not a word of hard description, somehow failing to notice that the unnamed Yezhov was a dwarf. Moreover, the protagonist never uses a word of Marxist jargon.
This puts additional flesh on some of the implausibilities I mentioned earlier. It isn't plausible that Michael, at age 14, could cross the Polish-Soviet border in 1931 because the border was closed. It isn't plausible that he would have had the same handler supervising him throughout the Stalinist purges. And it certainly isn't plausible that his spy chain, which was based on his contacts with the uncle in Leningrad, would have functioned during the period when the Nazis had Leningrad under siege for almost 3 years during World War II. Michael does record one instance where he met with one of his uncle's superiors, and if Misel is correct that this would have been Nikolai Yezhov, who was the head of the NKVD or Soviet security police during the Great Purge, then it's implausible that Michael would note meeting the man but fail to mention that he was a dwarf. Yezhov stood 4'11" tall, and he was sadistic enough that he was nicknamed the Poison Dwarf and the Bloody Dwarf. Michael records his personal impressions of the spymaster that he met, including unflattering ones, so it isn't likely that he would omit something as striking as the fact the man was a dwarf. And finally, it is very striking that Michael never uses communist or Soviet jargon in the book. Further, following up on a point she made in her 2002 article, Misel continues.
The Soviets, like the present Red Chinese, had no interest in altering Christian beliefs. Theology was irrelevant. A compliant church loyal to the regime and its peace initiatives was quite enough. AA 1025 notwithstanding, the Venona documents, intercepted Soviet intelligence, speak of military spying and influence on many sectors of American society, but not the Catholic Church or any other religion.
So yeah, if the communists had an enormous project of spying on religion in the West, why doesn't it show up in the Venona decrypts, which were decrypted Soviet messages that the U.S. got from 1943 to 1980? And if the Soviets really had a massive effort to spy on and undermine religion in the West, you'd expect that project to show up in these documents. And yes, by the way, we will have a future episode on the Venona Project.
Misel has identified several additional implausibilities with the story in AA 1025. But can we go beyond just implausibilities? Is there anything that would show that this is a work of fiction?
Yes, there's a statement that's printed right at the front of the book, but it seems to have escaped the attention of the book's strongest believers. It says,
"Notice from the French edition. This book is a dramatized presentation of certain facts which are occurring in the church and which are perplexing to many of the faithful. All resemblance to persons or contemporary events are not to be considered as purely accidental."
So the original French edition of the book carried a warning that this was a dramatized presentation. In other words, it's fiction. It's supposedly based on real things, the certain facts that the notice mentions. And so it says that the resemblance to persons and contemporary events are not to be considered purely accidental, but it's still a work of fiction. In other words, there was no manuscript of memoirs of a communist spy found on a man who had been fatally injured in a car crash. That's a fictional scenario devised by the author to allow her to explore events taking place in the church and what she believes is behind them.
But wait, the Tan Books edition says that Marie Carré was the nurse who found the manuscript. How do you explain that?
It seems that Thomas A. Nelson, the founder and publisher of Tan Books at the time, was simply confused. It also appears that he assumed that the story was nonfiction, and so he assumed that Marie Carré was the nurse used in the framing narrative.
What do we know about Marie Carré? What are the facts of her life?
I've looked up Carré's biography on the website of her current French publisher, Scheer, and it mentions that she was a convert from Calvinism. It also turns out that she was a rather prolific author. Between 1958 and 1980, she published books with titles like The J3 Against Lucifer, The Good and the Dead, I Choose Unity, Memoirs of a Cheerful Girl, Life of Jesus, The Mass, Open Letter to Jesus of Nazareth in Galilee, Islam and Us, and The Shepherd of Shepherds. When I first began researching this story, I couldn't tell if Carré was ever a nurse, though. So I thought, you know, maybe Thomas Nelson might have simply confused her with the narrator of the book or the nurse who finds the manuscript in the book and just assumed that they were one of the same. And so he put that on the back of the book. However, I pursued the matter further with the help of author Kevin Simons, who speaks French. We contacted the publisher of her French biography, and it turned out that she was a nurse. So that much was true. And Carré seems to have based the character of the nurse on herself. But the nurse in the book is still a fictional character. Thomas Nelson didn't even read the manuscript in front of him that closely, because in the prologue of the book, the character of the nurse says this:
"I am only a nurse, and I saw, in a country that I will not name, in a hospital that must remain anonymous, I saw a man die following an automobile accident. Do not try to find out who I am. You will never do so."
The first statement would make next to no sense if Carré herself was the same as the character of the nurse. She lived in France, and so it would seem obvious what country she was in when she witnessed this happen in a hospital. It would have happened in France, and it would make little sense to refer to the events in a country that I will not name. The second statement, "Do not try to find out who I am, you will never do so," would make absolutely no sense if Carré is the same as the character of the nurse, because she was publishing AA25 under her own name. So how would she come off saying, "Don't try to find out who I am, you will never do so," when it says it's by Marie Carré? It would be obvious that she was the nurse if this were a nonfiction account. The fact that the character in the prologue says we won't be able to find out who she is presupposes that she's not the same person as Marie Carré, and that points to this being fiction. That's something else that's confirmed by the French publisher's website. Its page on the book has a bookstore review that says,
"Constantly reissued since its first publication in 1972, this novel has enjoyed considerable and well-deserved success. Marie Carré, from the pen of a nurse, reveals the mission of a strange seminarian student."
So this alerts to the reader that this is a novel, and it uses the French word roman, or novel, in the original French text. It also says that Marie Carré reveals the mission of the seminarian from the pen of a nurse, meaning that the nurse is a fictional character in the novel that Carré uses to help reveal the fictional story of Michael. But Thomas Nelson was seriously confused about the nature of the book he was reprinting, and he did a disservice to numerous people in the English-speaking world by portraying it as nonfiction when in fact it was a novel.
Do we have any other confirmation of that?
Yes, and in the words of Marie Carré herself. As I was preparing this episode, Kevin Simons checked the November-December issue of Lecture et Tradition, which is a French traditionalist journal. And it has a special interview with Carré by Alexander Barivaux. In the interview, we find this exchange.
Why did you write AA 1025, The Memoirs of an Anti-Apostle? Do you really believe that there are anti-apostles in our free world?
I really think there must be anti-apostles, since Pius XII spoke about them.
What were the reactions of your first readers?
Some took this little work, where I only fictionalized some of my memories concerning the new things that were suggested to us here and there. They took it, I say, for a strictly historical document, and experienced one as great hope and great joy. But they didn't always cope well with the disappointment that followed.
So there you have it, in Marie Carré's own words. It was based on her memories of the new things or novelties that had been proposed in the church in recent years, and she fictionalized a narrative around them. However, some of her readers took it as a strictly historical document, and this brought them great joy, presumably because at last they had an explanation for the changes in the church that they were disappointed with. It was all due to a communist infiltrator who had the codename AA-1025. But then they were disappointed by what followed, presumably Carré's correction that the book was actually a fictionalized narrative based on her own memories of recent years and not a historical document. In any event, Carré herself indicates the book's nature. It was a novel.
Then let's look at the second theory we need to consider, that even if the book itself is a novel, something like this must have happened, and so communist infiltrators were responsible for the described problems in the church.
The idea here would presumably be that even if AA 1025 is fiction, that communist agents did infiltrate the Catholic Church and that they are responsible for the problems in the church today, including those cited in traditionalist criticisms. I don't have any problem saying that some people in the Catholic Church ended up as communist agents. The Catholic Church contains a sixth of humanity, and there are bad apples in every group, especially large groups like that. So I have no doubt that Soviet intelligence was able to turn some Catholics and get them to be their agents, just like we turn in here in the West, we turned some Russians and got them to be our agents. But I don't think that it's at all likely that they had any large-scale seminary infiltration project. It's too hard to get young men to make commitments to be lifelong sleeper agents this way, what with celibacy and all, not to mention the fact that many priests practice poverty. The much more plausible scenario for communist infiltration than trying to infiltrate seminaries is taking the low-hanging fruit, which would be people who are already priests and bishops. If I were a Soviet spy master, I'd use my intelligence resources to dig up dirt on men who are already priests and bishops. For example, finding out about their having affairs or engaging in financial misconduct, and then I'd blackmail them into working for me, as well as offering them money to work for me and thus taint them, making it less likely that they'll turn again in the future. I also might engage in a kind of protection racket, telling them that if they don't work for me, I'll make sure that bad things happen to those they care about, including people in their flocks. And to avoid this, all they need to do is slip me some information from time to time. Turning people who are already priests and bishops would be much easier, as well as much quicker and more efficient, than finding people willing to be lifelong sleeper agents and getting them through seminary. If there were seminarians who were agents, I would suspect that they would be blackmail targets rather than volunteers like Michael. But I also wonder how many seminarians would even come up on Soviet radar to blackmail. So I don't have a problem with the idea that during the Cold War, the Soviets managed to recruit some priests and bishops as agents, particularly behind the Iron Curtain. But I'm very doubtful of any large-scale seminary and insertion program in the West.
What about the idea that Soviet agents inside the priesthood were responsible for contemporary problems in the church?
I don't see any evidence for this, certainly not on a large scale, and nothing like what's claimed in the book. As Sandra Miesel noted, the Soviets didn't mess with the religious doctrine or worship practices of the churches they actually had influence over in their territory. So it's scarcely likely that they would attempt a worldwide disruption of the Catholic Church or other churches in the West. When it comes to the churches in the communist country, they were happy as long as the churches were outwardly loyal and didn't cause problems. They also undoubtedly tried to use them as tools to spy on their own citizens. So, since so many countries behind the Iron Curtain had extensive secret police networks that would have included people in churches, including church leaders. But the evidence that has emerged both during the Cold War, like the Venona decrypts, and after the fall of the Soviet Union, when KGB and other intelligence files became accessible to Western scholars, the evidence simply has not turned up anything suggesting that the Soviets were embarked on a large-scale program to try to get the Catholic Church or other Western churches to change their doctrines or alter their liturgies. I can't think of even one case where something like that has been verified. Now, that's not to say that the Soviets didn't try to do things to undermine religion in the West. In fact, they did, and we can talk about that in the future. But the way they did it was by spreading propaganda and by using fellow travelers or people sympathetic to communism. They didn't try embedding sleeper agents in seminaries.
Then it sounds like you're basically trending toward the third theory that you mentioned, that the story of AA 1025 is basically fiction. Although this doesn't mean that there was no communist infiltration or subversion of religion in the West.
Yeah, that's correct. This is the most logical conclusion, at least based on the evidence that has emerged thus far. But you know, I'm always open to seeing new evidence. And by evidence, I mean evidence, not just claims or rumors.
So setting aside the mistaken idea that AA 1025 is a work of nonfiction, what do you make of it as a work of literature?
I'm not really impressed with it. On a literary level, it just isn't impressive. It contains too many implausibilities and isn't realistic at all. I'd much rather read Tom Clancy Cold War thrillers than this. They have much better grounding in history and plausibility.
And setting that aside, what about the claim that AA 1025 is still a work of remarkable insight?
This view is taken up by Alice von Hildebrand in her response to Sandra Miesel. Von Hildebrand kind of straddles the fence on whether AA 1025 is nonfiction. She's open to the idea that it is nonfiction, but she questions this and spends time exploring the idea that it may be a fictional account. She writes,
"I grant Miesel that one can raise many questions concerning the authenticity of this document. I have raised them myself. But once again, this does not prove, without a shadow of a doubt, that it is not valid. AA 1025 may be a literary invention of Marie Carré, but one must admit that she hits the bullseye from the first page to the last. Some people have extraordinary talents to foresee the future. Carré certainly had an extraordinary perception of how best to harm the church. How surprising, indeed, that all her inventions have become reality in the post-conciliar church."
And to this, Sandra Miesel responds by citing a bunch of things that Michael said he wanted to implement in the book. And she says,
"It hardly took much prophetic skill to predict the vernacular mass in 1972 when AA 1025 was written. As for hitting the bull's eye from the first page to the last, do we have ordained fathers and mothers celebrating Mass on the family table before dinner every night? Are the naves of our churches filled with communion tables for groups of 12? Have we abolished infant baptism, marriage ceremonies, private confession, vestments, altar cloths, candles, the sign of the cross, the Sunday Mass obligation, the term Catholic? Are believers in union with the Pope ever likely to do so? As I said, AA 1025 is a fable seething with hatred of ecumenism. I don't understand why someone of Dr. von Hildebrand's stature would give it a second glance."
And I don't either, except for the fact that it feeds into von Hildebrand's preferred narrative. People tend to love things that confirm their own views and preferences, but the book doesn't contain any great insights, and it's easy to predict things in hindsight because you already know what occurred. And you can then make up even more extreme things as a warning of what might happen in the future. Basically, Carré made a list of all the standard traditionalist criticisms of changes in the church that had occurred by 1972, and then she attributed them all to this one imaginary guy. That's not foresight. It's hindsight coupled with an implausible explanation of this one dude being responsible for everything. And of the things Michael says he wants to implement, like having parents say mass before dinner at home and abolishing infant baptism, private confession, the sign of the cross, and the term Catholic, none of those have happened since 1972, and none of them are likely to happen in the foreseeable future. So Carré is actually not great at predicting what would happen after her time. She's just not some dramatic, insightful visionary. Instead, she serves up a tale of an unlikable, megalomaniacal protagonist who lives a melodramatic life story that is completely implausible. I understand why some people find this tale compelling, but it's entirely because it feeds into their preferred narrative and their darker impulses. In recent times, the word porn has come to be used outside of its original context to refer to things like food porn, which is material designed as a form of entertainment to portray food in an especially compelling way, or house porn, which is designed to as a form of entertainment to portray houses and real estate in an especially compelling way. Well, I hate to say it, but the checklist of traditionalist complaints offered in AA 1025, coupled with the idea that all the problems in the church today are due to a sinister conspiracy rather than just incompetence or just differences of opinion, makes AA 1025 come across not as a serious, insightful literary work, but as an implausible tale of what could be called traditionalist conspiracy porn. And that's my bottom line.
And Jimmy, what further resources can we offer to the viewer and listener?
We'll have a link to Marie Carré's book, AA 1025, The Memoirs of an Anti-Apostle, Sandra Meisel's article, Swinging at Windmills, Alice von Hildebrand and Sandra Meisel's exchange following that article. Also a link to Marie Carré's biography in French, and also a problematic biography of her that appears on Wikipedia. We'll have links to information on the Touch of Death martial arts move, the reported one. Also information about stylometry, Nikolai Yezhov, the Venona Project, and Shear's page on AA 1025.
And now it's time to hear from you. What are your theories about Marie Carré, AA 1025, and communist infiltration of the church? You can let us know by visiting sqpn.com or the Jimmy Akins Mysterious World Facebook page, sending an email to feedback@mysterious.fm, sending a tweet to @mys_world, visiting the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord, or by calling our mysterious feedback line at 619-738-4515. That's 619-738-4515.
And I want to say a special word of thanks to Oasis Studio 7 for the video and animation work in this episode. They're available for hire, so you can check out their work by going to my YouTube page and watching the Mysterious World videos there. The video really adds a lot to what you would hear in the audio of the show. My YouTube page is youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. And while you're there, be sure to like the video and comment on the video, because that tells YouTube you found it engaging. And so other people will too, and it will share it with more people. So you're helping us grow that way. Also, we recently passed 50,000 subscribers and we're on our way to 100. We'll get there, but not without your help. So please do subscribe. And be sure to hit the bell notification when you do that, so that you always get notified whenever I have a video. Mysterious World comes out once a week, sometimes more, but I usually have multiple videos coming out every week now. So be sure and subscribe and hit the bell. Also today, I want to say a special thanks to author Kevin Simons for his help researching this episode. He's got several books out that deal with applying critical thinking to traditionalist subjects. So be sure and check them out.
And thank you to Angela Cialana, Noel Crow, Isabella Bettinelli, and Rob Mady for their voiceover work on this episode. And Jimmy, what's our next episode going to be about?
Next week is a Fifth Friday, so we're going to be having our regular Fifth Friday Weird Questions episode, and I'll be talking about things like, should Elrond have just killed Isildur? Understanding the Divine Mercy Chaplet, reported time travelers from the future, teleportation clones and confession, Jesus, aliens, and salvation, Gulf War Syndrome, Klingon baptisms, ancient Egyptian spelling bees, Adam and Eve's belly buttons, and superhuman brains that don't have immortal souls.
Excellent. Folks, be sure to share the podcast with your friends and write a review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts to help us grow this community and reach more listeners. You can find links to Jimmy's resources from our discussion on our show notes at mysterious.fm/303. And remember, to help us continue to produce the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
The Grady Group, a Catholic company bringing financial clarity to their clients across the United States, using safe money options to produce reasonable rates of return for their clients. Learn more at gradygroupinc.com. And by Great Lakes Customs Law, helping importers and individuals with seizures, penalties, and compliance with U.S. customs matters throughout the United States. Visit GreatLakesCustomsLaw.com. And by Rosary Army, featuring award-winning Catholic podcasts, rosary resources, videos, and the School of Mary online community, prayer, and learning platform. Learn how to make them, pray them, and give them away while growing in your faith at RosaryArmy.com and SchoolofMary.com.
Until next time, Jimmy Akin, thank you for exploring with us our mysterious world.
Thanks, Dom.
And I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on StarQuest.
If you've enjoyed Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you'll also enjoy another StarQuest Network show, The Secrets of Star Wars. Find it wherever you can find podcasts or at sqpn.com/StarWars.